Thank you very much. It's an honor to speak here, to be back, great pleasure. So I chose a not so general title. Had I chosen a more general title, that is gauge theory and quantum degradability, the talk would have been much longer and it would have been much more speculative, unfortunately. I mean, I wish I could give a talk on gauge theory and quantum degradability.
So it's not commutative?
It's definitely not. So, so there are several instances where one actually finds the relation between the quantum integrable systems and gauge theories in supersymmetric context mostly, and several groups of people work on different aspects of that. So I will just mention them, and we'll go on with the story which I'm most familiar with. So there is a story of computing the anomalous dimensions of various local operators in N+4 supranodules in the Lagrangian limit, and the story of computing the expectation values of Wilson loops and scattering amplitudes, and in all this, so again, in mostly in the Lagrangian limit. And in these stories, one finds remarkably that the these anomalous dimensions, for example, are the eigenvalues of some kind of spin chain operators, spin chain Hamiltonians, which is solvable by the beta ansatz techniques. Both beta ansatz dressed with various complications, which we will discuss. We will find in the story which I'm going to present as well, although. The story which I'm going to talk about has nothing to do with the high energy states the operators which create out of vacuum. The states which are very far in the Hilbert space of a theory. So the story which I'm going to talk about seems to be kind of at a different corner of the. Of the map of the relation between these two subjects, but I feel that there is actually an intimate relation, and so maybe one day when we will be able to switch these two subjects, we'll find out that these are actually two dual sides of the same picture. So, so the story which I'm going to talk about is the relation between the vacuum. Supersymmetric gauge theories and quantum integral systems. So the gauge theories which I'm going to talk about will be required to have a two-dimensional n equals to 2 comma 2 super Poincaré invariants. That is to say, they have four supercharges. But the theories themselves don't have to be two-dimensional. So they could be a four-dimensional gauge theory. Could be a complexification of the 0 to 6-dimensional theory on some manifold. We only need the four supercharges, which will in particular generate the two-dimensional translations, and that seems to be enough to produce in the space of all operators in the theory so-called twisted chiral ring. So I put twisted in the brackets because the two-dimensional mirror symmetry exchanges twisted chirals with chirals, so it's also sometimes reveals themselves as a chiral ring, which is actually commutative associative algebra. For which the space of supersymmetric vacua is a representation. And it is this algebra which we want to identify with the with quantum integrals of motion. Of some quantum integrable system. I still don't know what is a quantum integrable system. I mean, what is the good definition? Intuitively, this is something which you would get by quantizing a classical integrable system. And a classical integrable system, you have a symplectic manifold or a Poisson manifold, and you have a maximal set of Poisson commuting functions, which are functionally independent. So when quantizing, you want to somehow mimic this picture. So you want to have a, in the space of all observables, which are in general, which form a non-commutative algebra, you want to have a commutative subalgebra. And you want it to be maximal in the sense that in the Hilbert space of your model, so in the representation of the algebra of all observables, this commutative subalgebra will at least separate states. So you could find, let's say, a basis of common eigenstates for your commuting Hamiltonians. So that's an intuitive analog of the notion that the classical Hamiltonians form a maximally functional functionally independent set.
Is it a number or a finite number?
The algebra, so how to say it? The algebra might have a finite number of generators, but they will generate, as a vector space, it will be an infinite dimensional space, typically. It depends. I mean, you could have, I mean, the interesting examples of these quantum integral systems are, let's say, spin chains where everything is finite dimensional, the algebra itself, the space of states and the algebra.
But there are an infinite number of Hamiltonians.
Yes, but since the in that example which I just mentioned, since they act in a finite dimensional space, there is a kind of infinite redundancy. But if you consider, let's say, all spin chains with the same symmetry, let's say all spin chains which have a Youngian of SL2 as a symmetry, then taken in this entirety, they will be independent. So that infinite dimensionality will actually play a role. Okay, so anyway, so this is somewhat abstract, and the remarkable, so and the way you get this commutative subalgebra is kind of kinematic, just follows from supersymmetry. What's remarkable is that how it works at examples. So how the familiar supersymmetric gauge theories lead to familiar quantum integrable systems and vice versa. So when I give these talks, I invoke the notion of naturalness, which somehow reflects something about our brains, which the things we consider natural on one side of the story map to something which other people consider natural on the other side of the story. And I mean, for the last 30 or 40 years, these were mostly different, non-overlapping groups of people who worked on quantum integrable systems and gauge theories, and later years on supersymmetric gauge theories. So it's remarkable that people come to the same sort of.
And what was the difficulty to compute what this chiral ring is, for example?
Well, you need to make some preparations in order for this to be really manageable object, because if you...
In other words, it's clear from the outset that this is going to give you some commuting operation.
Yes, but if you deal with quantum real system in abstract setting, you don't know what it is. It's just some commutative algebra, and there are as many commutative algebras as varieties, and so
it's just finding a way to describe.
Right. So it's somehow pinning down the interesting description of the quantum real system is part of the story. So,
but would you not hope for more that other properties of the quantum integrable system, besides the commutative part, were also encoded in the game?
Right. So once you identify these things, you can actually start making use of this equivalence. And there are things which you know hold on the quantum integral side. For example, the presence of quite often there are these infinite dimensional. Please. Okay. This blackboard has to have a feature that it actually suggests words that you, what you're writing, because it's blackboard or something.
Sometimes it makes an orthographical mistake.
Yes, yes, I noticed that in your talk. Yes.
And likewise. But when you're a speaker, you don't see that.
So. Right, it's...
Certain aberration.
So, for example, in quantum mechanical systems like spin chains, often come with an infinite dimensional symmetry algebra which actually is spectrum generating. Like Yang-Yang. Or quantum affine algebras. Or something like that. And as I will explain, the set of vacua, the spatial vacua of a given supersymmetric gauge theory, is actually it's a subspace in the space of all states of a given quantum integrable system, and this infinite dimensional algebra actually acts irreducibly, so it generates all the states. So you get from that an idea that there are some kind of symmetries, the generalized symmetries, which act between quantum field theory. Actually, first of all, between the vacua of a given quantum field theory. And secondly, they map actually different QFTs to each other. So, when we first discovered that and sort of realized that the consequence of this equivalence is that, and by we, I mean we were really surprised and thought that it means something really crazy, because what it means is implies in particular is that your in the notion of the gauge group, let's say, of the theory which you work with, may change, because you can act by one of the generalized symmetry operators and find yourself in a theory with a different gauge group. So yesterday you were living with the standard model. Then today I'm applying the symmetry operator and you're in grand unified theory. So it's
what does it do with the flavor symmetries, the global symmetries?
It depends. So in the example which I give, it will preserve global symmetries. So but actually when you think about the way symmetries probably are realized, they're realized by some kind of domain walls which in ordering QFTs, you can actually
nowadays this is a rather popular subject, so
I now know much less about this than most of the people in this audience. You can actually find consistent boundary conditions between two quantum field theories, and in the context of supersymmetric field theories, you have more constraints in order for these boundary conditions to be interesting. And one way to think about them is to consider the so-called folded theory, and then you're just dealing with a particular D-brain. Now, in this picture, so this is like a spatial slice, or you could think of, so let's see, time goes parallel to the domain walls, or to the separation between these two field theories. But you can imagine doing a weak rotation. And that becomes something really crazy, because now suppose now time flows horizontally. So you start with QFT1. It evolves for some time, and then you insert this boundary condition, but now it's a boundary condition in time. And out goes another quantum field theory. So, and in particular, if here you had a vacuum, some particular vacuum of that theory, out will go some other vacuum of another theory. And you can actually you can compose these things, map back QFT1, get another vacuum. And a priori, you wouldn't call these operations in symmetry. These are some operations. But the idea to consider this came is from the setting where they were symmetries. And they were forming these infinite-dimensional algebras, which on the spin chain side, indeed are the symmetry of the problem. They're not the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, so they don't commute to the Hamiltonian. That's why they're spectrum generating. But the Hamiltonians of the spin chain are not the Hamiltonian of the quantum field theory we're talking about. So this is.
Talking about supersymmetric.
That's supersymmetric, right? But of course, I mean, this. But its domain wall acts on the full quantum field theory, and it does not. So
you don't know how it acts, right? You only know how it acts on the supersymmetric state.
Right. I don't know how it acts. In fact, I don't even know very precisely how to formulate these boundary conditions. But the indication is that there is a way to formulate them, and as you formulate them in the full theory, they will act on the full spectrum. So of course, if vacuum comes here and you have a domain wall which sits at some particular moment of time, at the output you'll get most likely some excited state. But as you wait for a long time, it will relax into a vacuum. And if in the supersymmetric context, the kind of vacuum you will get, we know from the relation to the spin chain. Okay, let me be a little bit more specific.
It is a generalization of SDRT.
Say again?
It is a generalization of SDRT, so this operation acting on field.
Oh, I'm not sure. Well, I don't know what relation of that to SDRT actually.
SDRT is not an example of this, but because domain wall you have SDRT wall.
No. I mean, it's S. There is a letter S here in the sense that it's an S brain because it's something which happens at a fixed moment of time. But I'm not sure that the S duality wall is an example of this.
It's different.
I think it is. No, I mean, the way you think about it is they're most likely these things are obtained by the weak rotation of rather standard-looking D-brains in these folded theories. But I don't think anybody actually worked out the S-brain version of those. Anyway, let me give you an example which will explain why.
I understand this question about S duality. I mean, are these two dimensional, or these are quantum field theories with two dimensional supersymmetry?
Right, but the domain wall, of course, will break part of it.
Yeah, but I mean, S duality is what usually.
No, but you could think. I mean, the question is valid because you could, as I said, I don't need this to be a two dimensional theory. I only need to have a two dimensional
supercomputer. Theory with supersymmetry broken to two comma two. But then what would S duality, what's an example?
Well, I mean, if you take n equals to 2 star theory, that would already suffice. There is a version
n equals 2 star with a surface operator.
With the omega deformation, which will break the surface. You don't need to insert an actual surface operator. You can also ask why is it important that we talk about the gauge theory, not about any supersymmetric field theory? Because I said that the Kyle ring is you can write it. I mean, you can define for any theory with two-dimensional n equals to 2 supersymmetry. What gauge theory gives you, in addition, is a certain rigidity in the sense that it has a set of observables which you construct out of the scalar in the vector multiplet, for which you have a natural basis coming from the characteristic polynomials, characteristic classes. So it's a basis of polynomials which are normalized in such a way that when you represent by these operators the characteristic classes of universal bundles, you get integrally normalized classes. So there is a normalization of these things. And then the second thing is that when you map everything to the gauge theory with two-dimensional super Poincaré invariants, one of the supersymmetry protected couplings which you get is the so-called twisted superpotential. And that's what makes this whole story interesting, because so it's a holomorphic multivalued function of the space of scalars. So these are the complex scalar in the vector multiplet. Incidentally, if you think about these two-dimensional n equals two theories as dimensional reductions of four-dimensional theories, then the scalar sigma would be the transverse the components of the gauge field in the directions in which you reduce. So this would be like the transverse modes of the gluon field, something which is also suggestive. Anyway, so this is a So it's an analog of a superpotential for the matter fields, but it's more interesting because unlike a superpotential for which you're only interested in critical points which define the vacuum, here, because of the issues with the fluxes, the vacua are determined. By more interesting equation, sigma is actually usually, well, sigma takes values in the complexified Lie algebra of the gauge group, but at lower energy you can think of sigma sitting in the complexified Lie algebra of the maximal torus, and so JR. So it's a function now of the rank variables, of the rank of the gauge group variables.
Where does this equation come
from? And, well, that's, you get it by minimizing the effective potential. So this just like the superpotential.
How does it enter the Lagrangian in a way?
So let me just give you a Carroll story for the Carroll fields. So if you have a superpotential, the effective potential would be something like the norm squared of the derivative of the superpotential. So to minimize that, and to get the vacuum, you at least need to minimize the potential.
That's the bosonic part.
That's the bosonic part. So the bosonic part of x bar would be the norm squared of the derivative superpotential. For the twisted potential, the story is more intricate because of the interaction with the gauge field. So the bosonic part of a Lagrangian, put it this way, will involve terms like the norm squared of the gauge field strength plus the coupling of the imaginary part of the derivative of this twisted potential to the field strength. So this is the curvature of the abelian gauge field plus the absolute value squared of the real part.
Which abelian?
Just one second. So it's a general situation. The general situation is that at lower energies the gauge group reduces to its maximal torus. So you have just a bunch of U1 gauge factors in the amount of R. And so the gauge fields and then the curvatures Fi, and so this is the structure of the effective Lagrangian, the bosonic part of the effective Lagrangian. What you see for the chiral fields, there is a similar formula, except that there F is an independent field, and you can integrate it out, and so you get the square of everything. So this is how you get this. But for the twisted chiral fields, F is not really an independent field. It's almost an independent field in two dimensions, except that it's quantized, right? There is a flux. And that's a dual number. So I'm always confused about that, but it seems to me that the fluxes are quantized in the units. So they represent the weights for the dual group, and this equation equates the derivative of the twisted potential with the weights of the original gauge group.
Is there a Poisson summation here if I make the substitution?
Yeah, you do the summation.
Do a Poisson summation, and then I get dw tilde by.
So in order to derive this equation, what you do, you relax this constraint, you compensate by adding kind of a dual variable, which is discrete, to the Lagrangian, sum over n's. Then F becomes an independent field, because in two dimensions, applications formations I mean, you could go to the gauge and say where A will be determined by F, the Coulomb gauge.
Is this integral over R2? So there's a theory.
It's two-dimensional. So this is in the picture where we have a two-dimensional theory.
You're thinking theory on R2, not R times its mass.
Well, think about Riemann surface. S2 will do.
So it's a similar calculation like in TPR, right?
Yes, it's a similar estimation, except that there you have a dual scalar field. Here you really have, this is just a discrete variable, so it's not a propagating field, it's just discrete degree of freedom. Anyway, so I mean the meaning of this N is like the electric charge. So if you want to give the Hamiltonian interpretation of what's going on, so do it on a cylinder, not on a compact Riemann surface, then the meaning of N will be essentially the electric charge of your vacuum. And so what this equation says is that this charge is compensated by the effects of by some effective charge which is constructed out of the scalars.
Did you say that this W twiddle was a multi-valued function?
It's multi-valued, right? Okay.
But sigma is valued just as a function of sigma, but sigma is in the simply connected domain, right?
Well, not quite, because of course, you see, the point is that this whole low energy theory approximation is valid not for all values of sigma. Namely, it's only valid where you don't get some accidental fields becoming massless, something like that. So typically, W tilde will actually have singularities at the loci where some fields become massless. And also, typically, what happens is that this equation doesn't let you go there, so you actually don't hit these points. You don't correspond to vacuum. But sometimes, I mean, people are very intricate, so you can actually invent the matter content and adjust parameters in such a way that you actually will be forced to go to this bad loci where another branch will emerge. And so you can
something about the choice of the NJ, or the NJ's arbitrary?
We have some over all of them and explore the space solution.
So for every set of, I thought there were restrictions on these things. Of yours, or are you, so you're saying that
no,
for arbitrary tuples of integers there will be we write down
these equations and see what happens.
What
there is some subtlety, namely, is that there is some redundancy in these equations, namely because of the multivariedness of W tilde, you actually you may discover that if you write this equation for all branches of W tilde, you actually may overcount. Taken as an entirety, this is what you study. So the example which we all know is the simplest example which we all know is that.
Do you know of an explicit connection of this to the attractor equation, or is it just vaguely like?
Right. We have some remarks, so we actually 97 laws. Well, we were studying in that paper, we studied four-dimensional gauge theories. And one thing which you can do, you can study, if you take N equals 2 four-dimensional gauge theory and compactify in a two-sphere, I mean, you'll get a two-dimensional N equals 2 theory, I mean, with the partial twist, of course. With the kind of disconnected space of so it will be a kind of B model with disconnected target space, which will be labeled by the electric and magnetic charges which would let flowing through the sphere, and then you find that you'll get precisely these equations for the vacuum. Which you can also identify with attractor equations, because you could engineer the N equals 2 theory by compactifying, by studying the Calabi-Yau compactification of type 2B theory or type 2A, quite matter, and then those fluxes would translate to the charges of black hole. So
Well, you're engineering on a non-compact volume.
Well, yes, but then you can imagine it's, it should be, if you dress it up with supergravity and then, you know. Okay. It's a limit, so it will be a limit of black hole in the limit where you decouple gravity and then it can't be out the decoupling compact. Anyway, these are the same equations actually. So we also study the, you know, the solitons connecting different things and those the flow equations and things like that. So the only thing which is missing in this formulation is that in the example which I just gave you with the S2 compactification, you had actually two kinds of charges, electric and magnetic charges. And here you only see one set of charges.
Oh, I see. So these are purely electric. Oh, I see. This N is not living.
Right. So the second charge is sort of hidden in W tilde. Because for different magnetic fluxes, you'll get different charges. Anyway, that's an old story. So it's what's remarkable is that when you actually look at this W tilde for simple theories like example which I like is you take un, so let's do a two-dimensional case. You take un gauge theory, which starts as actually n equals to 4 gauge theory, with L hypermultiplets. In fundamental representation. So it's like a quiver theory. Except, well, so you have this is a color node, and this is a flavor node. And then you give the so-called twisted masses, the general twisted masses, which would be consistent with n equals 2 supersymmetric subalgebra. So what these masses are, you can actually, so what they are, you can give mass, you can give different twisted masses to the flavors, so one mass per each hypermass per flavor. And in addition, when you look at the n equals 4 vector multiplet, so n equals 4 vector is equal to the n equals 2 vector plus n equals 2 chiral in the adjoint. So there is an additional chiral multiplet, and this scalar in the chiral adjoint multiplet interacts with the scalars in the fundamental hypermultiplet, which in turn also splits us to chiral multiplets, fundamental and anti-fundamental. So there is a superpotential, which has this form. And the superpotential has a symmetry, which is an R symmetry for the n equals 4, and just a symmetry for n equals 2, for particular n equals 2, under which q tilde and q have charge minus 1, and phi has charge plus 2. And so you can give so the twisted masses, they correspond to the symmetries, global symmetries, which commute with supercharges. And so given this global symmetry, you can also give so there is a twisted mass which is Okay. So when these masses are generic, when U1, UM, U are generic, all your matter fields are massive and can be integrated out.
Sorry, what was U?
So U is the mass, is the twisted mass which corresponds to that symmetry.
Oh, I see. Oh.
So under, so Q tilde will have a mass. So okay, so Flamer A Q A will have a mass minus U, let's say minus mu A. Q tilde A will have a mass minus U plus mu A. And phi will have the mass plus 2. So that's the table of masses. That's the adjoint. So once we integrate them out, well, there are many things which will be generated, but the twists of potential can be computed exactly. And that's the it's given by just one loop computation, because it's related to anomaly and all the usual non-normalization theorems. So it will depend on sigma 1, sigma n. We told that the gauge theory is n. So if I introduce the color indices here, then one thing which you might look at is the fermion masses, which are actually complex, and so the superpartners of these fields will have the masses which will depend on the value of the vector multiplied scalars. That's a simple calculation. So this just says that this guy is in the fundamental representation for the EH group UN, under fundamental for the flavor UL, and Q tilde is the opposite. And so that the assignment of weights for the flavor group and for the color group, and that just says that phi is an adjoint for the color group and has charge plus 2 for the 1R symmetry. Okay, so after all is done, you just sum up, so they all contribute additively to the effective twisted superpotential. And that's what they will contribute. So let me introduce one function. All the time, so it's an effect. It's the effective twisted potential induced by integrating out a field of mass x. So so the field phi will contribute this, and then. Flavors will contribute that. So now that you know the effective twisted superpotential, there's also a tree-level term which you could add, which has to do with the fact that this is a UN gauge theory, so it has a U1 factor, and so there is a corresponding coupling in the theory which is a theta angle in two dimensions. You can add angle, and there is a finite opposite term And so that's just, so that's, this term is present already at the true level. So now when you can substitute this effective process of potential into the equation for vacua, you'll get the famous equations. Might be missing some factors of 2 pi I. So these are the equations for the vacua. And well, the actual equation which you'll get will be the logarithm of that plus some an arbitrary integer. So when you take the exponential, you don't see the integers anymore. So
I have a question about
yes.
So you've made a specific renormalization choice here. I mean, you've set lambda to 1, but if you had changed lambda, you would have shifted w tilde by linear in the twisted masses and the sigmas, and that would have led to a twisting in the beta.
Well, I think it will be all absorbed in the. So it will be absorbed in the renormalization of the effective.
So the twisted masses cancel out.
Well, that's, you see, the point is that this theory in ultraviolet was n equals 4, so it was actually conformal. So I think lambda actually, as far as the gauge dependence, well, at least as far as the Coulomb parameter dependence, they should cancel.
This linear dependencies. Okay, last time I checked, I thought it actually led to a twisting of the beta lattice equation.
It's. I'm a bit surprised.
Now, why?
It might be. So, you see, of course, now that you've got this theory, you can take some limits where you will decouple some of the matter. And that would lead to the asymptotic P theories where the lambda, the dynamical scale, will actually reappear. And so that would lead to the fact that the Kähler. And these are the also known as scalar moduli. Would become dimensionful. But in this case, if you don't do this, if you don't take these limits, so this is an asymptotically conformal theory, so it should not happen. Well, you see, it's clear that. So what Greg is asking is that the results, I mean, I should really be using the regularized twisted potential. Speaking the truth. And if I change lambda, this will translate to the, so I will get something linear in all these guys. But you see, as far as the sigma and mu dependence are concerned, they will actually cancel. And that's because mu are the twisted masses which actually don't break n equals 4 supersymmetry. So they cannot generate beta function.
And the u also cancels?
But u actually might not, may prevail because u breaks n equals 4 down to n equals 2. But. It will translate into a constant in W tilde as far as the sigma dependence is concerned. And here we're interested in the derivatives of W tilde with respect to sigma. So if you want to make U dynamical, I mean, that's an interesting story, which I will not touch here, that will be important. But for this, for the present purposes, I think it's okay. So what are these equations? Well, these are the, this is the beta, these are the beta equations, this is not my consensus. For the XXX spin 1/2 speech. So you have L spins on the circle with the, let's say, one of the Hamiltonians is just the nearest neighbor interaction. Well, actually, the spins are sort of, so it's inhomogeneous. Daniel? In some sense, the locations are these two masses new, so they can be somewhat distorted from the uniform distribution. And there is also a twisting, as Greg mentioned, that there is some kind of boundary condition that as you go around. So there is a, if you like, an impurity which acts with some kind of a local magnetic field. So as you go around, your spins are acted upon by the e to the 2 pi I t, that very t, times the sigma 3 matrix.
Right. T is complex,
right? Everything is complex. So everything is complex, right? Of course, if you wanted to go back to the old...
that's not a unitary operation.
It's not a unitary operation. But of course, I mean, there is a unitary locus where t is real, which means no failure post-term for you, and mu's are, I guess,
also real.
That's a possibility. And actually, it's mu over u. And I think it's over I. So this is in a sector with n spins up. So for the XXX spin chain, which is an isotropic spin chain, the total projection of the spin on the vertical axis is a conserved quantity, so you can fix that. And so what you get here is it's a subsector where it's precisely n spins which point up. So
the Hilbert space,
the
chain space,
is
two-dimensional space.
So the Hilbert space with the Hilbert space of XXX is C2 to the power L. But you can split it into the subspaces. So the dimension of HN will be L choose N, where you have precisely N spins up. And
spanned by, well, or you can say it's a usual answer.
Global C2. So S3 is N minus L over 2 on H.
Why does N have to be bigger than L, less than L?
It doesn't have to be, just that when N is greater than L, you don't have vacuum state, so the supersymmetry is broken. So that's a claim that we have the ground states, so that the supersymmetric vacuum of that theory is this sector and subspace in the space of states of XXX spin chain. With all, you know, parameters of the Betanzas in it. So it's not just an accident that you get it for some particular value of, these are called impurities in the spin chain language. It's the whole family of the theories which are sort of mapped to the whole family of spin chains. But you get the surprise back because on the spin chain side, nothing stops you from flipping one spin. So you can change N. And there is a beautiful algebraic structure for doing that. So there is a Youngian of SO2 for which HXXX is irreducible for generic mu's. So there are algebraic operations which act on the space of spins which change n. And therefore, if we translate that to the original story, it means that we ought to be able to change the number of colors. Here we preserve the number of flavors, but there's more. Because, as I said, you can actually, you can vary mu's. And as I was saying to Andy, you can actually become so intricate that you can adjust mu's in such a way that something bad will happen, well, something interesting will happen. On the Youngian side, yes, it is. Well, what is, it ceases to become reducible, right? Reducible, okay, but not decomposable, right? So
what does it mean for
that? Right.
Just to say, for the Jungian, you have a two-dimensional representation, which is new.
Right. So the better way to write this is that is to say that this actually a tensor product. Okay, it's not new, it's new. Each of these are two-dimensional representations, and we're used to the fact that when you take a tensor product of irreducible representations, we get something reducible. But for me, it was a shock to find out that actually, for the Jungian, it's not the case. So if you take you take the tensor products of these irreducible representations, and they're still irreducible. However, if, let's say, mu I minus mu j is equal to 2u, I think, in these notations, then this is not the case. So it becomes.
It depends on the order in which.
Right. Right. So.
That is not the case. So you're taking a tensor product of irreducible things and getting a reducible.
Right. And physically, what it means is that, well, you have two spins 1/2. And you start moving them, and you want to get at some point, you ought to be able to get a bound state where they will form a spin 1 or spin 0. And indeed, this is what happens. So you should be able to see how these two spins 1/2 form a bound state on the gauge to your side. And what happens is that you see, when the difference of masses is this, is precisely 2u. What happens is that you actually get a level crossing among the fields Q and Q tilde in the sense that the mass of one of the fields Q becomes the opposite of the mass of one of the fields Q tilde. And that means that you actually get a gauge invariant operator of the form QA. So suppose it was QA minus QA plus 1. If I'm not mistaken, it will be QA plus 1, QA. It's a kind of a meson field, which becomes suddenly massless, so to speak. So the total charge for all the symmetries becomes 0. And what it means is that you can actually now in a position to do two possible, to deform the theory in two possible ways. One is to give an expectation value to this operator. The meson. So when mu a minus mu a plus 1. So let me call this operator O sub a. And so you can either give an expectation value to this operator, or you can deform the superpotential, which was originally just that, Q tilde phi Q, plus you can add this operator to the superpotential and deform the theory of this mass parameter, which you can turn on. And once you do that, you can actually integrate some of this. So when you deform the superpotential by a mask term, you can integrate the fields out, and that will generate couplings of the form Q tilde phi squared Q, which will actually correspond to the spin 1 impurity in the spin chain. So I should have explained that you see, here we have the spin chain with spins 1/2, but of course at least in two dimensions, and this was based on the symmetry considerations involving the standard superpotential, which was cubic, which was Q tilde phi Q. But in two dimensions, all these you can actually consider more general superpotentials. So Q is in fundamental, phi is in the adjoint, and Q tilde is under fundamental. So that's gauge invariant. And you want to keep this polynomial, so S A would be half integer. And how it will modify our story? Well, simply in order for the for this additional U1 symmetry to still act, you would need to modify the charges. So the charge of Q tilde and Q would be minus 2s, and the charge of phi would be still 2. And so that will translate, you repeat the same story, just modify the equations in the end in this form. And so what you will get the spin chain with general spins. And so this little story here explained how you can generate these high order polynomials out of the standard cubic polynomials by just integrating out additional fields. And so this on the spin chain side, this was just the fusing spin 1/2 to make higher order spin, higher spins.
I don't understand how you got this spin 1/2.
Okay. It's just a little
not obvious. I mean, okay, you don't have to. I'm just saying it's not needed.
I'm sorry. I should look. So it's just okay. So we have to look at two terms in the superpotential.
So you have this additional term.
So we deform. So we deform that mass. So we have a new mass. This is called complex mass, as opposed to twisted mass. This is forward. These are various, all these adjectives are very important. And then you can integrate out Q tilde A plus 1. So just solve, you see, it's just linearly. Think of it, just solve the equation of motion.
QA is equal to 5 QA plus 1.
Yes, therefore QA will be a negative M inverse
pi
A plus 1. So it's your substitute here, and what you'll get, Q A tilde pi squared A plus 1. That's the factor of potential. So you got rid of two fields, Q A tilde A plus 1, Q A plus 1 tilde, and Q A. So your spin chain sort of became shorter, but the spin got higher because of this.
So it's like you have to turn the product of two dimensional presentations.
Yes.
Fused. Three dimensional, right. One dimensional.
Right.
Three dimensional means spin one.
Right.
So you're saying you can reproduce it.
So picking out the spin one sub-representation corresponds to deforming the theory, and going and picking up the trivial representation, the one dimensional sub-representation. So just essentially removing this.
So taking the highest components.
Right. Means going on the other branch where this guy has an expectation value. Has an expectation value. So you don't, so instead of, you can also do it by playing with self-potential. You can add a spurious field. Two spurious fields, actually. View M as a chiral field. And so U is just a parameter, and then you add this guy to the potential, you add this guy to the potential. When you eliminate M, that forces all to have a vacuum expectation value. And so in the space of parameters, there is a locus where you actually have two branches emerging, and one is when you deform the theory by deforming the potential, and another when you deform the theory by giving the vacuum expectation value to this operator. And that's where you get this decomposition of the
So how did you say you remove the singlet part?
So, so you want to force this operator, this Meson operator, to have vacuum expectation value. So you want it to condense, and one way to do that is to add an additional field which will be neutral. So it will just only couple to this meson and add a linear term in this additional field to the superpotential times a C number, which will generate the expected value. And so here, once U is non-zero, you get the constraint that O is equal to U. So that moves you to another branch. And at the level of the space of vacuum, what will happen is that you will essentially remove one flavor. So you will remove two flavors. Right. As if two spins 1/2 on spin chain form trivial spin zero. So you just throw it away. So I'm just saying that some things which we can do and expect naturally, like on the spin chain side, on this more generally on this quantum integrable system side, can be reproduced in the gauge theory by some standard things like deforming the Lagrangian or theory of superpotential terms. But there are other things which are less expected, and I hope that are much more general than just this class of examples which I presented, because I really think that the fact that here we get this beautiful algebraic structure, and again, this is not just a single example. It's a whole body of examples involving Young-Young's quantum affine algebras, elliptic algebras, well, you know, the whole story with R matrices and Young-Baxter, and it's everything which we know on that side should have a translation to the supersymmetric gauge theory side, and maybe not only gauge theory but also the theory of supergravity. So supergravity, because, you know, some people are worried that we have a landscape of vacuum which have to do with the same actually quantum, I mean, with the same fluxes. You see, so this equation has an avatar in the four-dimensional physics with the flux compactifications. And so what I'm saying here is that in these examples, which are of course simplified, there is a symmetry algebra, which is not a Lie algebra, but it's a generalization of the Lie algebra, which acts between this vacuum. And I think it deserves, first of all, understanding on the gauge theory side, how does it act? What are the generators? So I gave us a picture which we have in mind. So these are some kind of boundary conditions between different theories, and maybe we can find the same structure, even more beautiful one, with the context of flux compactifications, where you have the condensation of brains, maybe they form an interesting algebra as well.
It does not change L here.
Here it does not change L. But of course, well, you see, what does it mean to change L? Well, you can bring something from infinity. So you can add additional.
I'm again wondering about what happens with the global system.
Right.
But by increasing S's, you can change. As he explained,
Greg wants to change a number of factors.
L becomes smaller, right?
Right. So one way is, once you have something, you can get rid of it. But it's very hard to get something out of nothing. So that's the famous rabbi said. Okay. Thank you. I over time and I didn't cover, you know, the whole story.
So you present this sort of as a miracle. Right?
Well, but that's,
it is sort of a miracle.
It is sort of a miracle.
So why, what is the, have a better understanding now, why is it a miracle?
Yes, we have a better understanding of that. Of unfortunately, not in, not in this case, for example. So there are ways of relating quantization of how to say it. There are things which we are already used to, so it's not there. It's I mean, it's still a miracle in a sense, but we're not surprised anymore. You know, in four-dimensional n equals two theories, the space of vacua, again, it just falls from consideration of supersymmetry and electromagnetic duality. The space of vacua is always a base of a complex classical integrable system, so which is now called Zabrick-Whitman integrable system. And if you deform the four-dimensional gauge theory by turning on the so-called omega deformation in two dimensions out of four to make it look like a two-dimensional theory with infinite number of fields, then you expect to get a quantization of the Zabrick-Whitman integral system, and you do get it. And there is an understanding why, in the sense that we can relate what happens on the gauge theory side to the way now people sort of understand the deformation quantization, using not quantum mechanics, but using the kind of topological string theory. So, using brains. So, so this is a kind of a technical explanation of why the quantum integral systems appear out of gauge theory, again, in the classic examples, of which this is probably a kind of a limited case, but it hasn't been worked out. It's not understood.
You mean because, like, the place, the Hilbert space appears as kind of a home between brains? Roughly, that's what
you mean. So the Hilbert space is a more
well, it's between two.
Right. So
what you're saying is that this quantum integral system here is a deformation of a classical integral system that appears in space of vacuum.
That, I mean, ultimately, yes. I don't know. I don't know how it works in this example. I don't know. But that's the flavor of it. Right.
Plus, in a sense, is a quantum version.
Right. So of course, for this quantum dual system, there is a classical limit. If you take the spins to infinity, so you get some phase space, and that corresponds to some four-dimensional equals to theory. So it will describe the space of vacuo for the classical. This classical system will describe the space of vacuo of
an equals. Well, explain where the classical comes from. So you're saying the quantum miracle is explained because it's quantization of Zabrick-Whitman.
Right. Right.
Zabrick-Whitman integral system, but why is there Zabrick-Whitman integral system to begin with? Or is that, you feel as though that's much?
Well, I mean, again, we understand this technically why it is so. So because of the, you know, the tori which you get from, well, let's say, compactifying four-dimensional theory in a circle, you get the Wilson loops and Dole loops take place.
So you
can explain by means of the classical,
right,
which you can explain in some way.
Right, but I wouldn't call it a deep explanation.
It's cheating. It's cheating. It's cheating.
And anyway, I like I like miracles more than that.
So, are all examples, all models you have, they're always dimensional reductions, higher dimensional models? Or do you have some, you know, two-dimensional field theories
which cannot be lifted to? Well, you see, already here, as I said. I mean, the matter content of the theory is obtained by dimensional reduction, but the theory itself is not, because this phi, which comes from the third and the fourth component of the gauge field, here I give it the mass, so I cannot do it in four dimensions. Unless you do something to the Lorentz invariance in four dimensions, which is a kind of different story. So.
I think we usually have on Thursdays in the afternoon, we have informal discussion, so I suggest that perhaps we have more detailed discussion at that point. So
okay. Well, then I could explain, I mean, maybe more about. So I present the class of quantum dual systems involving spin chains, but there is another class which, to my heart, is even more sort of dear, which are many body systems, which are people in condensed matter are probably also interested in.
So that's related to 4D.
And that's more of the 4D flavor.
Might be a four-dimensional integral with operators. You take a U of L n equals 2 theory.
You can embed this. You can embed this. Right. You can embed this theory into the four-dimensional as a surface defect, of course. Right. And in fact, it's even. Well, maybe we'll discuss it.
Sorry, let's get it.